and welcome to this International Airport View podcast. For this episode, we recorded on location in the beautiful city of Amsterdam at Passenger Terminal Expo 2023. I was joined here by Anthony Bernheim, Healthy and Resilient Buildings Programme Manager at San Francisco International Airport. Anthony discussed his role at SFO, how the airport views its role in the health and well-being of passengers, the threats facing airports and how they will need to work on their resilience for the future. Remember to subscribe to International Airport Review to be notified of all future podcasts. Anthony, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
My first question for you is about your job title. I'm quite interested in it. So tell me, what is actually meant by healthy and resilient buildings and why are they important to airports?
This is a great question. At least the why is it important to an airport? That, I think, is the key part of this. But let me go back a few years. When I joined the airport, my work focused initially on integrating innovative sustainability building practices into the new buildings that were coming into the airport. And these are large public projects, terminal buildings, office buildings, parking garages. I think that it's kind of like a little city with different kinds of buildings. And at that point, we were looking, this is what, 2013, 14, we were really just looking to see how do we integrate the right things. But over the years, the work has evolved, and with, specifically with the pandemic, I think the airport began to look at health and well-being in a new light. Obviously, the world did, and from my own perspective, and I'll say this in an interesting way, I've been working on the impact of human health in the built environment since probably the mid-1980s, and it's always been in the back room. And all of a sudden, well, you know all about this, so come and help us. So that was a major transition. In the last 5 years, there's been a huge uptick in understanding of sustainability, not just in airports, but in buildings as a whole. The industry has changed. And with the climate change and climate disruption that we have right now, I think, at least in the US, there's been an awakening on the issues of resilience. So the fact that we chose this title 5 years ago, 6 years ago, was actually fortuitous because we were looking ahead at what's coming. Just a very good look ahead. And just to finish that comment, during the pandemic, the airport redid its strategic, when I say the airport, I mean the San Francisco International Airport, SFO in short, redid its strategic plan, and they did a 5-year strategic plan called an interim strategic plan, which ends this year, and now we're starting the next one. But the last one was really looking at a couple of major things to do with health and well-being. One was health of passengers, one was health of employees that work at the airport, and the third one was the health and well-being of underrepresented community. Those are the folks that work, I'll say, on the apron level. They load baggage, they move planes around, they move food around. These are the people that can't just walk upstairs into a white-collar office and say, you know, I'm breathing air outside that's not good. So the awareness that there are other folks besides the white-collar folks on the upper level of the airport, the passengers and the employees, that we need to deal with. And so I was asked during the pandemic to actually put together presentations for both employees and for the airlines and for concessions on what the airport was doing from a health perspective. So it was a very fortuitous title. Now, why is this important? Because this, I think, is the more interesting part of this whole question. And you have to understand, I'm going to deal with health first and then resilience second. Health first. There are two types of health concerns, and I classify them as short-term and long-term. And we have to understand this. We have to understand that both the public and employees can be exposed to chemicals in a building short-term and long-term. There are short-term health impacts, and there are long-term health impacts. And you have to know that sick building syndrome symptoms, abbreviated SBSS, is short-term. It means that somebody walks into a building, and for a short while, they feel ill. They feel like they have a cold. Their eyes run, their nose might drip. If they're there a little bit longer, or they come back again, maybe they have dry skin every few days. You just don't feel right. And then when you leave the building, you start to feel healthy again. It takes an hour or so, and you get better. Those are sick building syndrome symptoms. And generally, they are not serious, but they cause the person not to feel good, and it's a perceptual problem. It may not be any long-term impact. It may just be something short-term. In an airport, you don't want passengers to walk in and feel ill and then leave and know that, I don't like going to that airport because there's always this funny odor or this funny smell. I never feel well there. I think I'll go to use the other airport. So that's short-term, and it applies to passengers primarily and to obviously employees. And if you think about an airport that, I think our airport last year had maybe 46 million people pass through, and if you understand that sometimes about 20% of the population may be impacted by this. They've been exposed to some chemical somewhere in their history, and they may have a slight minor reaction. That's SBSS. BRI, building-related illnesses, are clinically verifiable diseases that can be related to chemicals in a building, such as cancer, Legionella's disease. You work in a building for about 10, 12 years, you're exposed to formaldehyde. There's a study done in the California EPA, and the results are now used by LEED and BREEAM and all these other organizations. If you're exposed to formaldehyde for X number of years, you're probably going to potentially be exposed to some kind of cancer. And there are about 80 chemicals in a building. We know that what they are, and we know what the short-term, 1 hour, 8 hour, and long-term exposure may cause you. And this is primarily for building occupants, meaning the people that work in a building. So that's the second category. The third category is MCS, multiple chemical sensitivity. These are people that have been exposed to a chemical like formaldehyde, maybe in their own home. They bought a new house, the kitchen cabinets, bathroom cabinets have formaldehyde. They didn't get sick. They lived there for, you know, many years, brand new house. They loved it. They moved in. But the next time they walk into a building that has a chemical like formaldehyde in the air, they will have a very serious reaction and may end up in hospital. In other words, their organs, you know, basically give up, and you get taken away to be treated in a hospital. And there are people like this. I've met them. I've had to deal with them in my previous projects because I work on civic projects. And there are people in the public that are exposed to this. And so very early on in the industry, we had to get chemicals out of carpeting so that they could walk on floors and they could come into public buildings. And I've had to deal with that. So when you understand that we can deal with most of the population quite adequately, but there are people who have been exposed to some things, could be sick building syndrome symptoms, or it could be MCS. And when you deal with an airport, dealing with large public populations, we have to understand that in order to design an airport. So you asked me why healthy is important in an airport, and in my title, that's number one. Resilience is the second issue. And basically, that is an ability of an airport to function either partially or fully after an event. Okay, an event in our case could be San Francisco Airport sits between three major airport earthquake fault lines, and we are expecting to have major earthquakes. What happens when the building moves? What do we do? Is the building usable afterwards? Are the utilities usable afterwards? In other words, first we deal with life safety, get people out of the building safely or out of the road structure or to safety. That's the key issue. And then is how do we support the community? So let's say there was a big earthquake in San Francisco. Well, the city's down, the freeways are down. What happens is other agencies will want to come in to bring in supplies and to bring in medical folks and to bring in technical engineers to help rebuild. How do they get there? It's either helicopter or plane, and the airport has to be somewhat functional. Okay? If the sea level rises, if the climate changes, there are all factors that we've got to deal with. And then there's the human issue, because humans do certain things in buildings they shouldn't do, and particularly in airports. So we look at support for the community. We also look at business continuity, because if an airport shuts down, huge amount of money is not being made by both the city, the airport, the concessions, and people's livelihoods are at stake. So you look at all these things, and you start to say that an airport has major impact on the local economy. You know, we've dealt with life safety. Now we're dealing with the big picture. So you want to figure out how do you make airport more resilient, or how do you harden the infrastructure in the buildings as appropriate for the location, for the hazards you're dealing with. And as we can start to see climate change is here, we see climate disruption, and we now have to deal with it.
I mean, are job titles like yours quite common in airports?
I think most of the airports are using resilience officer or resilience manager or sustainability lead or something like that.
Yeah.
This one is somewhat
quite
unique.
Specific.
But it recognizes the things that are important to this airport and also the things that I can do.
Now, would you describe SFO's pre-existing airport from your specialist perspective? Is it 100% healthy and resilient? I guess not if they need you, but how would you describe it currently?
I mean, again, deal with health first and then resilience second, just because they're related but not related. This airport has made major advances on the health side of life. They have electric vehicles for the staff running around the airport, which means we burn less gas from car emissions, which is both an energy issue, but it is also a health issue because we're putting less particulate and greenhouse gases in the air. We have electric buses. We have an electric rail system that moves passengers between terminals. So we're going electric and getting away from diesel and gas burning equipment around the airport. We have EV charging for the staff. I can plug in my electric car. We have EV charging for passengers. They pay, we don't pay. It's a benefit. We have ground service equipment charging. 30% of the ground service equipment at SFO is now electric, and we're working to get to 100%. Those are the tugs that push back the aircraft. Those are the tugs that pull the baggage from the belts to the aircraft and back, and all the equipment that moves around the airport on the air side is all going electric. Okay, reducing gas, reducing particulate matter, all that stuff. We have ground power and ventilation for the aircraft. Because as soon as that aircraft stops, I think they have about 5 or 10 minutes, they have to switch off their engines, and we provide the power through the building, and we provide ventilation from the building to power the aircraft. So they're not running their engines while they're parked there, cleaner outdoor air. And the relationship is the air that's out there is the air we bring into the buildings. Okay? We brought in Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. It's a major arm of UC Berkeley, funded by the Department of Energy in the U.S. We brought them in as an independent group in 2016 to do outdoor air testing for us. And we did it right where the major, when I say the major, the big aircraft, the international aircraft, the ones with the big engines, not the little ones, the ones with the big engines, they line up, they turn again, they run their engines, and they start their takeoff. And right next to that is a freeway, our major north-south freeway. So we thought this is the worst spot on the airport. And it's right next to what we call a fire station, which is where people are living 24/7. And the air from there moves across the airport to all the terminals and office buildings. So if it's worse there, it's going to be better everywhere else because the wind generally moves it across. We had them do outdoor air testing to determine the ambient outdoor air quality at this airport so we could understand something. And we did this because we had a lot of air filtration manufacturers come to us to sell product. And they would come in, and I found it's sad, but it was amusing in 2016-17, where they would come in and say, use our air filtration system. It's used at Los Angeles Airport, or this airport, or that airport. It's the best in the world. And the next one would come in the same thing. And the last one came in with what we call a pickup truck. The back of it is open, and he had all these filters there. And we said, well, do any of those filters meet the requirements of that Lawrence Berkeley National Lab report? And he looked at me and he said, no, they don't know what they're talking about. So we wanted to understand what was going outside on outside so we could filter for it to make sure that when we brought the air into the buildings, we knew what we were filtering for. And it's different at every single airport because the different climates. You may have a humid climate that has very different air contamination. You may have a wind direction that's different. All kinds of things that are different. So we knew that the worst air quality in San Francisco is February and October, when there's high pressure over the Bay Area and the air doesn't move. The rest of the year, we have prevailing winds. So we understood that. They took this report and they gave us, this is the air quality that we want in the building based on the study that California EPA did with long-term health impacts. So we said, here's what's outdoors. Here's what we want indoors. And we gave it to the contractors, particularly the mechanical contractors. And we said, you tell us, using the research data that you can get to show us which filter can filter for those chemicals that are outdoors. And we also want to filter for odor, because we do not want passengers smelling jet fuel in a building, because even if there was or was not a problem, they would perceive that there's a problem, because when you smell odor, you think there's a problem. So we spent about 6 months working with the contractors with a little bit of support from Lawrence Berkeley National Lab as an independent. We didn't hire a consultant that is paid by anyone. We hired a completely independent group to give us this information. And they did this big spreadsheet, looked at all the different filter types, and they went to the manufacturers and asked for research reports to show us what would work and what wouldn't work. And we came up with one system. So we now filter the air. And the beauty of all this was that in 2020, right after the pandemic started, ACI, Airports Council International North America, put a group of us together to come up with how to filter the air to deal with aerosolized COVID particles that might get into the mechanical system. The advice that our group came up with is exactly what we put in our new buildings. So we actually solved the problem before the pandemic. And I was able to go to the airport staff when I was asked to present to them what we were doing to protect their health for COVID to say, we've done it. We did it before COVID. So in answer to your question, the airport has done a lot. We require our contractors and architects to specify low and no VOC emitting, volatile organic compound emitting products and materials. We meet LEED standards, we meet the WELL standards for those products. And just as an aside, I was part of the development of that standard for California in 2020, which is now in LEED and in WELL and all these other rating systems. So I know intimately how that standard works, and we only use, from the waterproof membrane inboard, we only use those clean products. That's a standard for our airport. We also use the LEED pre-occupancy air quality testing procedure. In other words, when a contractor's finished a building, they have to do air quality testing before handing it over to the airport to occupy. That has to meet the California standard, the LEED standard, and the WELL standard. So we do all of that. We have regular maintenance. We do commissioning of our buildings to make sure the systems operate. And I led a team to develop a standardized commissioning activation simulation program for the airport. We just published the standards, and they are now standards for the whole airport. In other words, we want to make sure that all the mechanical systems particularly are running the way they should be running in order to clean the air and provide adequate air for breathing in the breathing space. So it's health and comfort. We go through all that. We get LEED certification, we've got WELL certification, we've got FitWELL certifications to say that we've done all this stuff. But how do we really know that the air in these buildings is clean? And that is the big question we have raised. So we have started what's called an air quality framework program. We started it last year. Phase one, we took 5 indoor air quality sensors and we put them up in our new terminal. And we took 3 and we put them outside of that same terminal. And we ran a test for about a month and a half. It wasn't to test the air, but it was to test air quality sensors for accuracy and ability to detect air in a terminal building. It's a little different. Later on, we're going to do air quality testing, but first we had to find the right equipment. And we finished that, and we issued the report in December last year, a nice little report on the study that was done. We're now in phase 2, and we are developing what we call a business plan to introduce the idea of measuring and monitoring air quality and then using that data to manage the air handling systems. So traditionally, the air handling systems in most of our buildings basically manage air quality on temperature, humidity, time of day. They switch it on when you come in your office in the morning. They switch it off at 2 because it gets too hot, and they may put it on 5 because they just exit the air, and then they switch it off at 6 at night and it's done. Now we want to introduce AI, artificial intelligence, to say, well, we've got 300 people lined up for an aircraft in a waiting room over here and nobody over there in that waiting room. The air quality over here is getting bad, not just because of temperature and humidity, but because of people breathing out or because of the outdoor air coming in. So we have to then think about how do we get the artificial intelligence to tell the mechanical system to do something with the air quality when this happens. So that is the point of our phase 2 of the study, and we're in the midst of that right now. And once we have done that, then we're going to start to think about how do we bring this new technology into either individual buildings or the airport as a whole. Because if you can't measure, you can't manage. It's the standard statement. So we've done all this nice stuff, but now we've got to figure out, have we really achieved something? And by the way, the other thing I didn't mention is we're also now bringing SAFE, sustainable aviation fuel, to our aircraft airport. It burns cleaner than the traditional jet fuel. Well, maybe the air coming in is cleaner, but until we measure, we don't know. So, you know, I can't say it's 100% better, but the airport is doing everything it can to understand what to do. And now we're trying to figure out the next step in that equation. From a resilience perspective, what we did is we did a study. I did the study of all the seismic design for all the buildings in the airport to figure out which ones are done just to allow people to get out of the building, which ones are done as what we call essential facilities, like firehouse is an essential facility. It means it has to withstand an earthquake. It has to be pretty much functional after an earthquake, and the people in that building have to be able to use that building. While other facilities may allow people to get out, but they may withstand serious damage. And then, of course, the utilities. So we are in the midst of starting resilience planning. The Director of Sustainability, primary led an effort that I was part of to develop what we call a resilience framework, which was just an understanding of what the airport has, where we are now, what is the resilience, what is the planning for business continuity, where is that, what is the business continuity folks thinking about which airport buildings and facilities they need if there was an emergency of any kind. And we're putting all this together and we're bringing on a team to actually help us understand where to go with resilience on the infrastructure, meaning underground, utilities, buildings, vertical, the whole thing. So that study is about to start. So that one is going to take a little bit of work over the next few years.
I saw an opinion piece recently saying that America's airports aren't ready for climate change, saying there is a lack of major policy response. Do you actually agree with this?
So we spent all of 2022, about once a month, asking other airports to come online through, let's say, Zoom or Teams meetings to our airport to talk to our resilience team on what they were doing about resilience. At least two of the major airports that I know of, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, have developed plans. Some of the cities are developing plans. Some of the transportation organizations are developing plans, but a lot of them have not yet done so. So I would say there's a lot more work to be done. I think the American public has been divided politically on this whole issue of climate change and resilience. But I think a lot of the country in the last year or two have seen the impact of resilience or lack thereof in their communities. And so it's becoming more real, which means that more and more airports are beginning to understand they need to focus on it. So I think it's coming. I think there's a lot of planning that's needed. And the big issue is funding. It's going to take a lot of money to make get these airports to be way more resilient. And as I said in almost the first question, it's also about supporting the community. It's not just about making the airport as a business institution functional. It's about supporting the airport with the resources when something else happens in their community.
Now, what is the biggest threat to airports, in your opinion?
Well, here we are. Climate change and other hazards, whether there's climate disruption, seismic, human hazards. There are people that do things in airports they shouldn't do. We have to understand that that's going to continue to happen. So we've got that whole list of stuff that we've kind of covered in some of the other questions. Understanding the impact of indoor and outdoor environment on people and the impact of climate change on outdoor air quality. There's a little known fact. We focus on carbon dioxide equivalent, as the main problem in greenhouse gases. But there are a number of other gases in greenhouse gases that when exposed to sunlight, they transform into ozone. And ozone is a change agent. And ozone reacts with other chemicals because it's a change agent to form formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, and very fine particulate matter, which is now known as ultrafines. Formaldehyde is a carcinogen. Acetaldehyde is an irritant, a respiratory irritant. And ultrafines gets through the nose because it's so ultrafine, very fine, into the lungs and into the bloodstream. And so there are some health impacts that we really haven't focused on from climate change. And we ignore that because we're focused on carbon, which is the right thing to do. But we also have to focus on human beings because we might make our buildings stiffer and we might do better on the big wall to keep the ocean out. But if we don't keep people healthy, we haven't done our job. So that's the second one. The third one is, we are in a period of very rapid technology change. It's been happening in the last 5 years. In the US, we sit close to Silicon Valley. We're close to Massachusetts and Boston. The technology industry has come to the building industry. The building industry used to be concrete, steel, bricks, mortar, drywall, you know, all the standard stuff. Now it's coming with glazing that is light sensitive, has sensor technology in it, and it's run through the sensor technology. And what we have to face is that a lot of our building systems and technology, each one of those technologies has sensor technology or artificial intelligence or software that is used to run it. Now, buildings are really systems. It's kind of like our body. It's a whole system. You can't just deal with one system without dealing with the other. And unfortunately, the technology isn't there yet to integrate all of this and make it work as a whole system. And there was a discussion at the U.S. Green Building Council, a Green Build conference last year. It's a session I gave last week through a little webinar we had, and it's about how this technology has to come together and we have to figure out how to make it all work together. And so that's for the buildings. But at the same time, the technology on the aircraft side is changing. They're looking at better engine technology. They're looking at SAF, sustainable aviation fuel. They're starting to look in the long term at electric and hydrogen power for aircraft. What's that going to mean to an airport design? You know, how do we provide the utilities that they need? You know, traditionally, they'd have a truck drive up to the aircraft and pump fuel in. Today, we pump it underground from a central source. Well, tomorrow, are we going to plug it in, and where's that energy coming from? You know, and how do we make that energy efficient if we're plugging an airplane in? So these are things we have to think about in terms of this rapid technology change. And the last one is a very interesting one that we've begun to talk about, and it's the long-term building maintenance and ongoing commissioning. And the reason I say that, it's because we are designing very high-performance buildings for LEED in the US, for BREEAM in England, and for other green building rating systems around the world. We're all using new technology. An example is, historically, you had a big mechanical system on the top of a building, and it pumped air in, and an engineer somewhere in the back of the building switched it on and off at different times of the day. And then we had a timer. Now, the contractors come in and they install this big piece of equipment, and then they hire the technicians to come in and install the software, and they program it to do all this stuff. Well, who maintains this over the life of the building? It's not the old engineer with the wrench that used to come in and fix that piece of equipment. It's now somebody who understands the software technology and knows how to reprogram it when things don't work or when we have an emergency out in the building. We don't have those people. And we need to go out into the communities and find those people. So there's a group near Boston in Massachusetts that is developing a training program that is being brought to each of the communities, and they go out into disadvantaged communities to help these youngsters understand that they don't have to do things that they shouldn't do in the community, drug dealing, etc., but they can actually be trained to run software, and if they learn how to use the software, they can actually become building engineers and operate these new, very high-tech buildings that we can't find these people today, and yet we're already delivering these buildings. So that's a huge challenge in my world.
Well, you know, we've covered so much, but perhaps like my final question then for you very quickly is just what's on your personal agenda for this year in terms of your role?
Number one is decarbonization. And by decarbonization, I mean two things, electrification to the extent we can, and the other one is decarbonization of building materials and products. Because as the buildings become more energy efficient and their carbon emissions are reduced, the percentage of carbon used to make the buildings goes up. And there's a whole group in discussion now in the U.S. on how do we find and get the manufacturers to improve their manufacturing process and their way of putting products together with reduced carbon emissions. So that's the big one. We're getting there on concrete. We're kind of getting there on steel. We've got to work on glass. These are long-term products. These are products that stay in a building for 20, 50 years. We forget about the other products because something like carpet paint, they may last 5 years, but if you take their lifespan of a 50-year building, you've got to change them every 5 to 10 years because they wear out. Yeah. We can't just ignore the carbon footprint of those lighter materials. So that's the first big one is decarbonization. And the other bit of interest on that one is that the mechanical industry is looking at, because they have these big units on top of buildings, they're just starting to think about how to make their materials more recyclable, demountable, so they can become part of the circular economy. Reuse those equipments and pieces of equipment in some way. So that's number one. Number two is obviously supporting the health in built environment. We've got to identify strategies and we've got to figure out how to measure and manage. Number three is smart building technology integration to achieve energy efficiency at the same time as improved human health. Those are the things I'm working on, long-term adaptation and resilience. And my big summary is we've understood sustainability. We've been working on that for years, and that's almost doing less bad. Now we've got to focus on adaptation and resilience, make our facilities, our infrastructure, more resilient to climate change, because it is going to change. But at the end of the day, the other big R is regeneration. In other words, we have to think about how we do better. Can we generate more energy than we need? Can we make the buildings more healthy in the long run? We've just got to do way more better. Can we plant more trees to absorb more carbon dioxide and provide healthy environments? So you've got to look at the whole thing to make it better. And that's what I'm focused on for this year and next year.
Wow, sounds like you've got a lot on your plate.
Yes.
But we'll be watching very closely for any announcements. But Anthony, that was my final question. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you very much for listening to this International Airport Review podcast. Remember to subscribe to the magazine and follow our podcast channel to be notified every time a new episode is posted. Thank you again, and make sure you come back again soon to listen to our next guest.